Welcome to Üretim Bandı Teknik. Hello everyone, welcome to the podcast. I'm Ender. Today my guest is Jason. Welcome, Jason.
Merhaba.
Jason, start to learn Turkish.
Yeah, I can say one word.
All right. Everything starts with one word, you know.
Yeah, you know, when I know one word, I've gone from I don't speak any Turkish to now I speak a little bit of Turkish.
Your Turkish is better than my English, I guess. Anyway, all right, Jason. And thank you to be guest here. I'm very glad to be your host today. But first, would you like to tell about yourself?
Absolutely. So I've been programming for a long time. I started in the mid-90s when I was about 13. I put just an HTML website online, and that was kind of what I consider my first foray into programming. And then I got maybe my first real job around 2005. And then since then, I've been steadily working in the industry. For the last 10 years or so, I've been doing primarily Ruby on Rails. And then for the last few years of that, I've been doing a lot of blogging and conference speaking and podcasting, Ruby on Rails and other topics.
Yeah, but maybe we can talk about your software life. And you are a software engineer also, am I right?
Yeah, exactly. And we can dive into any part of that that you would like to. My current role, I work for a medical clinic. The medical clinic is based in Las Vegas, Nevada. I started off as their first programmer. Actually, I built a custom medical record system for them. And I've been doing that now for just over 3 years.
Ah, I see. But why did you change your career to making a podcast and writing a blog post or writing a book or giving some talks to all over the world? Why?
Great question. I wouldn't call it a change. It's just something I do on top of everything else. So I think some people have this kind of personality characteristic where they just feel a need to express themselves. And I apparently have that characteristic. And I think it's what drives people to write blog posts and give conference talks and stuff like that. So I am not sure why I do those things. I just do. But also, I think what started me in that direction is, quite frankly, I wanted to make some money. And so that's why I sell my books and stuff and all that stuff, because I like to be able to put a book out there, people buy it, and I get a little extra money in my pocket. It's really nice.
But, you know, writing a book is hard. How can I say you wrote a great book and we're gonna talk about it, but how did you start to write it?
Well, thank you for saying that. The current iteration of the book out there, the what I call the Complete Guide to Rails Testing is the title of the book. That is kind of the second edition of that book. Prior to this book, I had a different book called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, which is no longer on the market. That was, quite frankly, that book was not nearly as good as this one, because back then, I didn't really know how to teach the material. I haven't learned a lot more about testing since then, but I've learned a lot more about how to teach testing. I'll give you the whole story a little bit. So first of all, I started writing blog posts about testing because I wanted to have a focus that I could blog about in order to get traction. If you just blog about random things, one day you blog about databases, the next day you blog about JavaScript, whatever, and you're just all over the place, it's gonna be hard to get traction. So I wanted to have something that was a narrow focus. And I decided to try testing, so I wrote some blog posts on testing. And then eventually, I collected some blog posts, and then I added to that, and I packaged that up in an ebook. And I sold that, and that became my first book, The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. And I thought it was pretty good. At the time, I thought it was pretty good. And I still think it probably was pretty good. But I realized over time that that book was not nearly as good as it could be. Because I started realizing questions people tended to ask. I started seeing patterns over and over. There were certain questions that people would ask. I'm actually going to pull it up real quick. I wrote this guide that I offer at railstestingguide.com where I list these questions. Okay, so here's the kind of questions people tend to ask. What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools and how do I use them? Which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? There's all these different questions that come up over and over. So at the time I wrote my first book, I wasn't aware of these questions so much, but then I started to come across them over and over and I said, okay, I need to address these questions in my book. And so that's part of what went into the process of kind of writing the second version of the book.
Yeah, and I saw the book and I guess there are 200 pages in there. And it's a little bit middle huge book, you know. And I just worry about how did you do the structure of the book? Because the writing book is not easy, you know, not writing a, like a blog post or something, you know. Book is very different, I guess.
That's true, but I think it becomes easier if you lower your standards a little bit. And so I didn't hold myself to the same standards that I might if I was trying to win a Pulitzer Prize or something like that. I just wanted to take the information that I had in my head and convey it as best as I could. And for me, I just pulled up the sales page for my book so I could remind myself. There's kind of six main areas that I realized people need to learn about. And this is another thing that I didn't know for the first edition, and then I learned it for the second edition. People want to know, I'll just list them real quick. People want to know about FactoryBot, RSpec syntax, system specs, model specs, request specs, mocks and stubs, and lastly, VCR and WebMock. So when I created the second edition of my book, the second version of my book, it was kind of split up into those areas. And so this book was a much more like, the first book took the form of like a big long tutorial where all that stuff was kind of mixed together, which for learning purposes, I think it's not as good if it's all mixed together. So this one, I was careful to separate these things so that, okay, here's the FactoryBot section. We're dealing only with FactoryBot here. Here's the RSpec syntax section. We're dealing only with syntax here. So that's where that came from.
Maybe we can a little bit talk about the book, the topics. For example, you said Minitest versus RSpec. This is a huge fight in the our world, the Rails developer world. And you pushed a survey on Twitter and RSpec wins. Am I right?
You could say that it won, but I don't know if I would use the term win. It's just the data said that more people used RSpec according to that very informal survey. The thing with that is, I think most people don't need to worry about even really having an opinion or getting the right answer or whatever, because the chances are that somebody else is going to make the choice for you. You get a job somewhere, you open up their code base, and you say, oh, I see that you guys use RSpec. I guess I'm going to learn RSpec. And the choice is made for you. And so the whole conversation is irrelevant about which is better and stuff like that because you don't have a choice. So that's the way I look at it. And then there's another way of looking at it strictly from a marketability standpoint. If you learn RSpec versus if you learn Minitest, how are your job prospects going to be? And again, I think it's actually irrelevant because I would never interview a candidate and say, oh, I see that you have really strong Minitest skills, but we use RSpec here, so sorry, we're looking for an RSpec person. No, because 99% of the testing skills are the exact same and they're technology independent. And so that's the thing I'm looking for, not the particular framework that you use. And so that leaves, if you're creating your own project for your own enjoyment, then you have to make a choice. Or maybe if you're a founder and you expect to hire developers in the future, then you have to make a choice. But that's the vast minority of choices. The vast majority of the cases, it's either not your choice or it doesn't matter that much for learning purposes. So it's kind of a moot point for me.
And you claim that the testing skills, except the tools, is very important. And I just want to talk about these things. For example, when should not write tests?
When should you not write tests? Yeah, that's a really good question. So I'm a little bit unlike a lot of people, perhaps, with how I approach this. I'm not big on going by numbers and metrics and that kind of thing, but I prefer to go by feelings. So I'm going to circle back to your question, but first I want to talk just a tiny bit about test coverage. Common question is, how much test coverage should I shoot for? And I say, Don't shoot for a number, but rather let certain things guide you. For example, are you able to get deployments out easily and without fear? Do deployments feel like a really big deal where you need to do a lot of manual testing beforehand? Well, if so, that tells you that you could benefit from more automated testing. How about your development workflow? Are you constantly playing whack-a-mole when you build features because you have to make a code change and then you test it manually somehow and it works fine, but then you make a change and it breaks the original functionality and all that? If there's pain in your development process of that nature, then that's probably a sign that you could benefit from more automated testing. What can't tell you is like, oh, my test coverage is 70% or it's 90%. That means nothing. What matters is what it feels like on a day-to-day basis to work with your code base. So I wanted to say that first so that I could come back around and say, what should you not write tests for? Well, my answer is everything. I write tests for just about everything. But sometimes there are things that I don't write tests for. If I find myself not really feeling like I would benefit from a test for that, like if it's just a tiny, like to take an extreme example, if it's just a text change or something like that, I'm not going to write a test for that kind of thing. And actually, I'm remembering something big. I see a lot of Rails developers making a mistake of writing what I call tautological tests. Tautological test is basically just a statement that confirms itself. And that's the definition of a tautology in general, is just like, it's not exactly the same thing. It's a circular argument, but it's kind of the same. A tautological test asks, is the code I wrote the code I wrote? Which, here's an example. Testing for the presence of associations. If I have a customer model that has many orders, I might write a test. If I was confused, I would write a test that asserts for the presence of that association that says a patient, that says a customer has many orders. But that is testing the implementation and not the behavior. And so that's a valueless test, because what makes sense to test is the behavior that that association enables, not the association itself. Because if you think about it, okay, what would the consequences be of removing that line that says has many orders? Well, then anything to do with patients and orders being connected would no longer work. You'd open that page and it would be broken when you try to use the feature. That's the thing you should test. Because if you take that line away, then that feature will be broken. The feature is the thing that actually matters, you know? I don't care whether that association line is present or not. If the feature somehow could work without that line being present, then great, it doesn't matter. That's not the thing I care about. The thing I care about is whether the feature actually works. So testing the behavior rather than the implementation is the way to go there.
Maybe in the problem is for developers, they really don't know how they can start to writing tests and using these tools. And what you do recommend to Rails developer, how should we start writing tests?
Yeah. So first of all, I want to say that learning how to write tests is very difficult and takes a long time. And so people starting to learn how to test their code should set their expectations accordingly. I think some people might feel behind, or they might feel like an imposter if they're not able to write tests. And those feelings are normal. And you shouldn't feel like this is something you just should be able to naturally know how to do or something like that. This is a set of skills that needs to be built over time, and it's not easy. So I just want to say that at the start. Some developers come to me and they say, hey, I have this application that I've been building for a year. Now I want to add tests to it. How do I do it? And that's pretty tough, because then you're doing two different hard things at the same time. One, you're learning testing, which, as I've said, is hard by itself. And also you're trying to retrofit an existing app with tests, which even for somebody who's really comfortable with testing and has been doing it for years and years, that's still really hard to do. And if you're trying to do both at the same time, good luck trying to do that. So I say to beginners, forget that. Don't try to do that. If you want to learn testing, here's what I would suggest. Create your own fresh Rails app just for fun. Doesn't have to be connected to anything real. And use that as a sandbox to teach yourself testing there. Then if you want to bring it back to your production app, you can do that. You can kind of go back and forth between your sandbox app and your production app. As you learn things and gain skills, you can bring those back to your production app. But as far as where to start with the actual types of tests, I always suggest with Rails to start with system specs. I'm going to use RSpec language because that's what I use. I always suggest starting with system specs. And the reason I suggest that is this. Of the different types of tests, system specs most closely mirror the steps that you would take to test something manually. So let's say, for example, if I wanted to write a system spec for a sign-in screen. Well, first, think about how you would want to test that manually. First thing, you would load the sign-in page. Then you would click on the username or email input, type in your email address. Then you would go to the password input, type in your password. Then you would click submit. And then you would check for some sign that you're signed in, the presence of some word on the subsequent page or something like that. It's pretty natural to translate those steps to code. So visit the page. If anybody's not familiar with the libraries that are involved, there's the Capybara library, which basically assists you in manipulating the browser. So Capybara has a command called visit. You do visit and then you give it a URL. Okay, so we have the first step taken care of. Has one called fill in. So that next step where you fill in your email, you say fill in email with user@example.com. And so on. You just translate step by step. And I even go so far sometimes as to write out the steps in English, or maybe in your case, Turkish. And then you would convert each step to Capybara and RSpec and Ruby. And there's really a one-to-one correspondence, so it's a fairly straightforward thing to grasp. And of course, you'll have to Google around and find the right syntax and all that stuff, but that's, you know, you can figure that out. It's the conceptual stuff that's often the hardest. So then once you have your test written, you can run it, you can fiddle with it until you get it working. And that can give you some confidence. That can give you a beachhead, because the difference between having zero tests working and having one test working is a much bigger difference than the difference between having one test that works and 100 tests that works. At least I would contend that that's the case. So that's where I recommend that people start.
Yeah, you gave lots of recommendation to Rails developers. Thank you for that. But the other things, you know, mocking some data and factories and fixtures. You wrote something about in your book, and what do you think, what you can say?
So mocks and stubs, that's another one that people ask about all the time. And I have a sense that maybe they ask about that because they feel like they should be using mocks and stubs, but they're not. And they wonder what the deal is with all that stuff. I personally haven't found many occasions where I needed or wanted to use mocks and stubs in Rails code. And I think maybe part of the reason for that is the nature of Rails is just that everything is available all the time. Okay, so let me say this. I'm going to back up a little bit. Why would a person want to use mocks and stubs? Usually on the occasions when I do want to use mocks and stubs, it's because I want to test a piece of behavior, but I don't want to have to bring all the dependencies into the picture that piece of behavior depends on. Because if I write a test to test a certain thing, but 90% of my setup code is all this irrelevant stuff that's just dependencies, then that's going to be a pretty confusing test, and it's probably going to be hard to work with. So it's much better if I can just, okay, here's an example. Let's say if I were writing some tests that were related to an accounting related area of my application, I wanted to do something related to a patient's balance. I'm going to use examples from my medical application. So a patient's balance can be affected by insurance payments, patient payments, all this different kind of stuff, charges, past appointments. There's all these different factors that can go into it. But maybe I just want to test something to do specifically with the patient balance. If I have to bring all these other concepts into the picture, it's going to muddy things up and make the test confusing and hard to work with. And it's going to make it more time consuming to write this test. So if I can just stub out, for example, an insurance balance, rather than having to create all these records to bring this insurance balance to what it needs to be, I can just say, hey, allow the patient's insurance to receive this certain method and respond with 462. and then I just get 462 rather than having to build that balance of $462 by creating all these records and stuff like that. So that's kind of the main use case for Moxon Stubs is to, well, one of the main use cases is to not have to deal with dependencies. But again, in most of my Rails applications, that scenario doesn't come up a huge amount of the time. I could say more, but I'll pause there in case you have any follow-up questions.
So I see, but this is enough, I think, because, you know, the mocking the data, I guess, is harder than the starting to writing test. Because developer, they have to know the data and the other things, you know. So maybe it's not important, but the hard things in the test, the hardest things to mocking data.
Yeah, I would say like when you're learning anything hard, you have to be judicious about what you focus on and what you choose to ignore. You can't focus on everything because that's not a focus. You have to focus on what you can actually move forward with and accomplish. Okay, I'll give an example. Okay, so I'm a language dabbler. I've learned a little bit of a lot of different languages. And right now, the main language I'm learning is Mandarin Chinese. It's very difficult for an English speaker to learn Mandarin Chinese because unlike learning, for example, Spanish, there's nothing in common. Between English and Spanish, there's some of the same words. English and Mandarin, nothing's the same. And there's not only speaking, but there's also reading and writing. And we have, you know, the Chinese characters, everybody knows what those look like. And there's something called pinyin, which is the romanization of Chinese. So there's two different writing systems. In fact, there's three, but anyway, there's all this stuff and it's so hard and I can barely even like pronounce the words correctly. And so when I look at all these things that I'm going to have to ultimately be good at, I'm going to have to be able to know the words. I'm going to have to pronounce them correctly. I'm going to have to read and write traditional Chinese and read and write pinyin. That's so much stuff. Since I'm just a beginner, I'm going to say, okay, what out of all these things can I ignore? And I say, okay, I'm going to completely ignore reading and writing. I'm not even going to try to read and write in Chinese. I'm only going to try to speak. And so because I've chosen to focus on just speaking and ignoring everything else, I can actually make some progress. I can learn one word, then I can learn 5 words, then 100 words. And then maybe once I've learned 100 words, only then will I start trying to learn how to read and write. Same exact thing with learning testing. Mocks and stubs are something that I would say, just ignore that in the beginning. You can get to that later, but there's so many things you have to learn other than that, that that's something that you can defer to later.
Yeah, I see. Okay, thank you for all these things. Before the close the testing topic, I want to ask about more information. Would you like to add more about testing? Maybe I forget to ask.
Oh man.
You say, oh man, oh, lots of things I have.
Yeah, it's kind of like, so we've talked about programming a little bit. Anything more you want to say about programming? Like it's such a huge, broad area. Let me think for a second. What should we address regarding testing? Well, maybe I'll kind of repeat a couple of things that I've said already just to try to drive it home. So remember that learning testing is hard. It's going to take a really long time. And that's fine. Don't try to add testing to an existing project if you're also just learning testing. Learn testing separately. And don't try to learn everything at once. You can ignore 90% of it in the beginning because if you try to consume it all, you'll not make any progress. And then again, I'd suggest starting with system specs because it's easy to make that translation between here's how I test it manually. I do step 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, I'm going to translate to this automated test, steps 1, 2, 3, 4. I'd suggest starting there. So I don't know if I have anything to add beyond that, but I think what I just laid out is probably a pretty good way to go.
Thank you. All right, let's talk about your podcast called With Jason. How is it going?
I think it's going good. People, I always say that to my surprise, people actually listen to it, which I'm very grateful for. And also to my surprise, I'm able to keep finding guests for the podcast. I'm very grateful for that as well. And so I'll keep doing it as long as people keep listening.
I listened to the last episode. You talk about food, guitars, and AI programming, lots of things. It was very funny. It was very natural.
Yeah, we meander a lot on the show, which I really enjoy. And I've heard people say that they enjoy that too, which I'm glad they do, because there's no way that I'm just incapable of not doing that. But yeah, we jump all over the place. And I think I might go even broader in the future, because even though I'm going to be a Rails developer for the foreseeable future indefinitely, and I don't plan to leave Rails ever, I do want the freedom to be able to talk about anything. So the podcast used to be called Rails with Jason. Now it's called Code with Jason. And I'm looking forward to broadening the palette of guests who come on the show. So far, I've had mostly Rails programmers. In the future, I want to have all kinds of other programmers, but maybe even other kinds of people. Like, wouldn't it be interesting to hear from a scientist? Like, maybe get somebody from, or get an engineer, somebody from NASA or something like that, and hear about, like, okay, you build robots for NASA? Let's hear about that. And maybe we can learn something from that NASA roboticist and take that lesson back to our coding. Because I think a lot of times, the best lessons come from outside of a person's industry, and then you can bring that back to your industry. So I've broadened it a little bit, and I'm planning to broaden it even more in the future.
You changed your podcast name because of these reasons. And what is your planning about your podcast, and what will we see the future?
That's a really good question. Well, a little bit of what I said, where I broaden the guests, maybe scientists, professors, engineers, various book authors and stuff like that. But other than that, I don't plan to change a lot. Definitely still focused on programming, or at least lessons that can be applicable to programming. It'll probably continue to be eclectic, and we'll have random conversations about whatever it is. And honestly, I'm not really sure where it's ultimately going to go and stuff like that. I had no idea that it was going to become what it has become. I just started it kind of as an experiment to see what would happen. It's gone much better than I expected. So we'll see. I don't know. The future is unwritten.
Okay, I'm looking forward. So we talk about a little bit your software engineering, but I just want to ask, what's your daily routine in your software development life?
So my daily routine differs a little bit from my ideal daily routine, but I'll kind of try to describe both. So I get up. Currently, my alarm is set for 7 a.m., and I keep trying to ratchet that up earlier, but I keep failing, but I never get up later than about 7. But I'm a big believer in getting up early. Even though I'm not necessarily like a super-duper morning person, I think those first couple hours are the most productive of the day. I'm not sure exactly why that's the case, but I really think it's true maybe for most people, but definitely at least for me. So I get up as early as I can. My current office situation is that I work in a barn, and my barn is about 150 feet from my house. That's nice because even though I wake up relatively late at 7 a.m., I can still be sitting in front of the computer and working before 8 a.m. So I think that's great. If I can start working before 8 o'clock, that's a win to me. When I sit down in the morning, ideally I just get right started immediately on actual coding. Because I think if you spend your first few minutes on Twitter, other social media, reading the news and stuff like that, you're gonna change your mental state in a negative way. There's this book, Flow, by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, and he talks about a flow state versus psychic entropy, which is kind of the opposite. So a flow state is when you're not aware of the passage of time, you're just in the zone, you're really focused. And then psychic entropy is when you're scrambled and you're not focused. I've had mornings where I get undisciplined and I check Twitter and I find something interesting to read. And I before I know it, 35 minutes have gone by and I haven't done any real work. And now I'm just kind of scrambled, and it's really hard for me to get into that flow state when I start from that state of psychic entropy. I have a much better day on the days when I sit down and just immediately start working. What I really like to do is the previous day, I don't like to stop at a good stopping point. I like to stop in the middle of something. So I might even like leave my editor open and have a line of code like half typed, so that the next morning when I sit down, I don't have to think to myself, what am I going to work on today or anything like that. I sit down and I see, oh, this line is half typed out. I see that here's what needs to go next. And then, bam, I'm already in it and working. Then throughout the day, I'll maybe talk about a couple habits that I've developed. So here's a bad habit that I used to have. I used to drink coffee, which was helpful for me because I would feel okay in the first half of the day, but then I would eat lunch and I would get really tired around 2 or 3 p.m. Just so tired. Like, felt like I wanted more than anything in the world just to go to sleep. And that's bad. And I eventually realized that the reason was because I would go out to lunch with my coworkers and I would eat like a giant burrito for lunch or something like that. And obviously that's going to make you tired. I can't believe I didn't know that back then. So then one change I made years ago was I started eating a lighter lunch. But then I started drinking coffee because I realized that, okay, I eat lunch and I get tired, but I can drink some coffee and feel a little more alert. But the problem with that is you build a tolerance and you need more and more coffee as time goes by. And the highs are high, but the lows are lower. And so it makes you have a hard time sleeping. At least for me, I have a much harder time sleeping during the times that I'm consuming a lot of caffeine. So at some point, a year or two ago, I decided to stop drinking coffee, at least stop drinking it on a regular basis. I still indulge myself once in a while. But now I drink tea. I drink black tea, which is caffeinated, but not as caffeinated. And that has made a world of difference. Even though my highs of alertness are not as high anymore, my lows are not nearly as low. It's more of an even keel the whole day. So that's what I consider a positive habit. Also, I've started practicing what I guess you might call intermittent fasting, where most days I try not to eat anything before about 5 p.m., which sounds crazy, and maybe it is crazy, but the way that arose is on Easter this year, me and my friend, I had a friend over for Easter, he and his wife and kids, their whole family came over for Easter. And we ate so much on Easter. And that evening, I was just sitting there feeling so full. And I'm like, you know what, man? Let's try this. Let's not eat anything for the next 24 hours. And he said, okay. And so we did it. And I felt so good. It felt so good to get like all the way to empty. Because I, you know, to be honest, I hadn't had the feeling of actually feeling hungry for like years. And so I have kind of an overeating problem. Anyway, it felt so good to fast for 24 hours and just get all the way to empty. I said, what happens if every day I just don't eat until dinner and that's all I eat? And so I tried that and I thought it'd be too distracting, but it wasn't too distracting. And I actually felt so much more alert during the day. And so these days I fail some days and I'll like go inside and have a snack or whatever. But most of the days I don't eat anything. And I've spent a lot of time talking about this particular thing, but it has made such a huge difference in my alertness and therefore productivity. That both those things, like you can learn like new coding techniques and stuff like that, and that helps. But I think these other things that are like health-oriented things might make an even bigger difference.
You point out very important points. You can learn coding skills and we have to organize our lifestyle as a developer, you know, and maybe you tired because you wake up at 7 a.m. It's very early for me.
Oh, I go to bed pretty early too, maybe around 10 or 11. I guess that's not that early. But let's see, if you go to sleep at 11 p.m., that's 8 hours of sleep. So that's decent, I guess. Yeah, so I don't feel like I'm depriving myself of sleep most of the time. Yeah, when I try to wake up earlier though, like 6:30 or 6 or whatever, inevitably, I end up falling back and it doesn't work out that great.
But to be honest, I wake up 8 a.m. It's just 1 hour. But if I wake up 7 a.m., I feel a little bit tired, you know. But 8 is okay for me because in pandemic, I'm used to wake up in 8. So, okay, the last thing I want to talk about. You have been giving lots of talks in many countries. And so, would you like to speak in Turkey about testing?
I absolutely would like to speak in Turkey.
But online, you know?
Yeah, let me refer. I would love to speak in Turkey. I wouldn't just like it, I would love it. Yeah, and obviously we have to do it online because of the pandemic. Hopefully someday I can meet in person, but for starters, doing it online would be great.
Great. Okay, I take the word and I will touch with you for speaking. All right. Would you like to add more?
You know, there is just one more thing I'd like to add, because we were talking about productivity and all my habits and stuff like that that I wanted to share. I want to share one other thing. This is a topic that it's one of those things that I really want to talk about, but nobody seems to want to listen. But I guess you're forced to listen, dear listener, because you're listening to this podcast. And here's the topic. I think one of the most powerful skills that you can learn as a developer is learning about logic and epistemology. I got a couple fascinating books recently because I wanted to get better at determining what's true and what's not true. And that might sound like a trivial thing to figure out what's true and what's not true. It's like, obviously. But if you pay close attention, there are a lot of people in the world believe things that aren't true. And what do you think the chances are that you're the one person on the planet who doesn't believe anything that's not true? And so I don't want to believe anything that's not true, because if you believe things that aren't true, then you're going to have a more difficult time interfacing with reality and achieving your goals. So I said, okay, how do I get better at determining what's true? And I got a couple books on logic and epistemology. And things I learned, well, it kind of reinforced some things that I already learned, and it taught me some new things. I won't get too much into the details of it, but one thing I will mention is the idea of a logical argument and how that has to work. So with a logical argument, you start with premises, and then from those premises, you draw conclusions. In this particular book I read, I think it said, like, in order to draw a valid conclusion, you have to start with premises that are true. Because obviously, if you start with two premises and one premise is true and the other premise is false, and then you draw a conclusion based on those two premises, if one of your premises was false, then you can't be guaranteed that your conclusion is true. And some of this stuff is common sense, but it's kind of like there's a value in having this formalized common sense and having it all written down and having this, you might call it a mental toolkit, because sometimes it's easy to find out what's true, but sometimes it's not. Like, for example, if your website goes down, you say such and such happened and it was followed by such and such error, therefore the event must have caused the error. But just because sequentially the error followed the event that you think caused the error doesn't necessarily mean that one thing caused the other. And it's very easy, it's surprisingly easy to fool yourself into believing something that's not true. And even me, who cares so much about not believing things that aren't true, I fool myself on a regular basis. And I think, I fooled myself again, and I believe something that wasn't true, and that results in wasted time. So that's my monologue about logic and epistemology. I'd recommend people want to learn about that if they want to become more productive.
Yeah, maybe we should put this things or summary of these things to beginning of the podcast.
Sure, I'll share a link. I wrote a blog post. I wrote this blog post. Nobody cared about it, but I'll share the link in case anybody happens to be interested.
All right, maybe we can put blog post links on the notes. All right, but I missed something. Where people can you find out more about you?
The best place to go is codewithjason.com, and that's kind of the hub where you can find everything else.
You have a Twitter account or something?
I do have Twitter. I'm Jason Sweat on Twitter. SWETT is my last name.
Okay, I will put these stuffs to show notes. All right, thank you, Jason, coming up the podcast or the show. It was really nice for me.
Thanks so much for having me. I had a great time.
Okay, people, it's over. See you in the next episode. Bye-bye.